It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Today we're talking about snow kiting. What's that? Well, I really didn't get it until I saw a video we have on our website at alaskapublic.org. Imagine a skier attached to a kite that is large enough not only to get you scooting along over the snow, but even to pull you uphill like a rope tow. It's a way of bringing power to backcountry skiing. It looks crazy fun, and it also looks a little crazy, like the kiteboarders you see crashing through that cold gray water out on Turnagain Arm. I love hearing about new ways of challenging Alaska, so I'm really looking forward to today's show to learn, along with you, about snow kiting. And I have two veterans of this sport. The sport hasn't been around all that long, so you can't be too much of a veteran, but these guys know what they're talking about. John Sadusky was one of the first people to try this in Alaska. Thanks for being with us, John.
Glad to be here.
And Steve Carr has Alaska Kite Adventures, teaching people to do this, getting them out into the backcountry. Thanks for being with us, Steve.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
So tell me about, I've seen in the video, and I think people have seen these big kites and might have an idea of what this is, but tell me what it feels like to be out there on the snow and just have the wind scooting along. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, Charles, you're talking about snow kiting, which is really our favorite. And we really, really are into it. We got a big season here in Alaska. We got lots of wind, lots of places to go, and it is incredible. It's just, it's hard to explain, really, but it's just one of those things you got to do.
Yeah. So you're holding on to the kite sort of with a bar, and the wind is pulling you along, and you're sort of sailing the kite to get you going the direction you want. And how do you, and then you're also skiing. So it's sort of adding a whole different dimension of different muscles than you're used to in skiing, I would think.
Yeah, so in the snow kiting world, we're hooked to this giant power kite. And the kite is, it's tapped into a serious force. And you're committed. Once you're hooked in and you're committed, and if you could imagine, big, huge kite, four lines coming back to you, we got a control bar, and you're hooked in, and you're using your skis to edge across the wind. So we're really like sailors sailing across the wind, and we're just like a sailor would use the wind on the ocean. We're mm-hmm. just going with it, but we do have a lot of control, and that's the important thing to understand here is that we we can go where we want. Yeah, for the most part, we can go upwind really good and downwind and move around and climb mountains and all that good stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's watching the video is amazing because you can just see that you are skiing along at a pretty good clip on a flat. And then occasionally you're actually going uphill. So you're kind of using that force to pull you uphill, whereas a regular backcountry skier would be putting skins on and laboriously climbing.
That's right, Charles. Climbing uphill is one of the unique things to snow kiting, and it's really allowed us to escape the ski lifts, go up mountains. And really, we can go up and do powder turns back down with the kite following overhead. We can actually pack up the kite if we want to and just kind of free ski it. And it's really, really opened up a lot of Alaska to us. It's really exciting stuff.
So you were talking about control, and that would seem to, that is a key word for safety in skiing is control. Mm-hmm. But you also are tied into this powerful force that's mm-hmm. hauling you along. So how do you, if you need to stop or if you need to turn, how is that accomplished?
Yeah, we learned to manipulate the kite and position it in such a way where we can stop the action. We can depower the kite, and that has been a progression with modern...
Essentially spilling the wind.
That's right. Yeah, with modern equipment, it's allowed us to have way more control than the old days, and it's pretty darn safe now with the equipment we have. And there's also emergency releases that allow us to separate from the kite.
Going towards a cliff or something,
yeah.
You can just let go. Yeah.
If it's life or death, we'll release the thing. So.
And then you might lose it.
You might.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right. So that's Steve Carr with Alaska Kite Adventures. I've also got John Sadusky, who kind of a pioneer in this sport in Alaska. You have been doing it for a while. I asked Steve, what's the thrill, or what? How does it feel to do this? Give me your own answer for that. What's the attraction?
Well, I think that one thing about this sport that's very common in other sports is speed. And, you know, there's some limit to speed, but it's still that forward motion that's a good part of the attraction, mm-hmm. Whether you're doing this or say, downhill skiing or other types of sports.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, this has that element that Steve has already explained, that you can do different things than just going one direction and speed. You can do turns. You can, after you get a little bit more advanced, you can do jumps with these things with the, you know, reasonable limitations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's some people get very advanced and can do more advanced new maneuvers mm-hmm. that add another dimension to the kiting.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did you first get into it? What was your original experience with it?
Well, having windsurfed for many years, the transition to kiteboarding was kind of a similar sport. You have a board you're standing on, and you have a wing that's pulling it along. But the reason I got into it, a friend of mine had an interest and had already decided to make himself some kites because we didn't know where to get them. And so he introduced me to his kites and showed me how to use them. And then I moved on from there and started using my skis. He started on a snowboard. I started on skis.
With the homemade kite?
With the homemade kites.
Oh, wow.
Now, these kites were made from a design that he got off the web, and so they worked pretty well, but he had to make I think 4 or 5 different ones for the different wind speeds, so it's a pretty good sized project.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time it was fine. Nowadays we have sheetable kites, which gives us a whole different dimension that
What was that word?
A sheetable kite. What that means is that you have 4 lines, and just like on a windsurfer, you can sheet it in and out,
like a sailboat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I see.
And what that does for you is, because wind is seldom perfectly smooth, you have the ability to sheet in and out as you get gusts or holes in the wind. And also, there's a certain amount of adjustability to the kite by usually a strap or a rope that allows you to increase or decrease the power in a general sense. So you have more range in the newer kites, which really helps a lot, and I think it's much safer too.
Wow, I had no idea. So we're talking about snow kiting, and I also want to get into kiteboarding, and we might as well talk a little bit about windsurfing too. All 3 topics have come up on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. My guests are John Sadusky, who is just speaking, and Steve Carr, who's with Alaska Kite Adventures. John, explain for the people who are in their cars and don't know nothing about this, which I would describe me, the difference between kiteboarding and windsurfing. Windsurfing, you essentially have a surfboard, and you've got a and I guess this is a good question for you, Steve, but I mean you've got sort of, it's on a pivot, mm-hmm. right? And the mast is sort of, it's like a sailboat, but you're on a surfboard with a mast with a pivot. And then at some point somebody said, wait a minute, let's get rid of the mast and just have it be a kite. Who wants to jump in on that one?
Well, I guess I could answer that, since I've been doing both of them quite a few years. As I mentioned before, they're both basically a similar sport, and they're using the power of the wind to pull a wing, and having a wing pull you forward, and you're standing on some type of board. There's significant differences between those type of wings and the boards that we ride, but there's some similarities, and so I guess to simplify it, it's, you know, a matter of preference as to which sport you want to do. My choice is to do both of them, because there's advantages and disadvantages to both of them. I could go into those, but
sure.
It probably,
well, I mean,
is probably,
I see it, and I mean these kites, you see images or movies, and you know, we were talking about this a little bit before the show, Steve, about flying through the air, and this movie that we've got on our website shows, I mean, guys are jumping, but then they are holding air as if they're on the moon, right? They takes mm-hmm. a really long time to come down, which sounds like a really advanced technique, but you see that people who are kiteboarding in the water too, that they'll jump over a wave and then they sort of will take a lot of air and come down.
That's right, Charles. Yeah, you can get some huge air on these kites. And the advantage is when you land, if you do it right, you can land really soft. So jumping huge is a large part of kiting, no matter if you're on the water or on the snow.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
There's one thing I'd like to point out, though, that with windsurfing, you do the same thing.
Okay.
You can jump, but normally you need a launching ramp, more of a launching ramp, where with kiting, you can launch right off of flat water and get pretty big air.
What are the, I mean, is that the most hazardous of the techniques that you guys do, is the jumping and going airborne?
Yeah, of course. You know, everything that goes up must come down, right? So if you don't do it right, you're going to get, you know, splat. So we also do a lot of different tricks and maneuvers. That's every day for a kiter, most of the performance kiters that are out there. However, having said that, you don't have to be that guy. You know, this sport transcends every kind of style you can imagine. You can just be cruising and just go on tour. And that has been really attractive for a lot of people. A lot of the people that we're teaching these days are middle age, you know, on the snow, and they're just cruising around, having a good time, and being outdoors.
Wow, are people using this to go point to point, or?
Absolutely, and I'm glad you brought that up. There's a small contingent of people that are looking at it right now, and I'm working with them, and they're on the land over the snow and looking to go places, looking to go from village to village, place to place, and as a means of transportation to burn less fuel and maybe let the snow machine sit around for a little longer.
Oh, that's amazing. That's got to be a uniquely Alaskan thing, right?
That sure is.
Yeah.
That sure is. And, you know, further into that, what we've been doing is doing expeditions with kites, pulling the sled full of all our overnight gear and our survival gear, and taking long trips and exploring new areas and doing expeditions. And that's gone on. And
So give me an example of an expedition that somebody's done or that you've done.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, that was really what got me excited, and that kind of pushed me over the edge. Our good friend George Byrne been hounding me for years and trying to get into kiting, and I finally saw an expedition there in Greenland. The Pitterick team did the whole stretch of Greenland, south to north, actually. And that inspired me. And since then, I've gotten into it, and with my good friend Tom Fredericks and some others, we've gone around Alaska. We've done trips, long distance trips. An example would be probably one of our most memorable recent trips is going around Nunavak Island up and across, and the wind blows 24/7. It's completely treeless. Snow everywhere, really nice user-friendly terrain. You just don't get any better than that.
Wow. Because you don't really want big peaks and cliffs, right? The rolling terrain or flat terrain is okay.
That's really good. The nice thing about the rolling terrain is the wind tends to stay more laminar, consistent.
So it does become turbulent, which could deflate your kite and make it more difficult.
That's right. So once we get into, we do like mountains and climbing mountains and all that, but it is a lot more challenging because there is turbulence and dead spots. Mm-hmm. So yeah, train traps.
So how long did it take you to go across Nunavak Island? That's a big island.
Well, we spent about a week out there, and should be getting out there again soon, hopefully on a good snow year, maybe next year.
How many miles would you plan to do on one of these trips in a day?
Well, that all depends
on... Because you can go really fast.
We can do a lot. We can do easily 80 miles a day.
Wow.
Easily, yeah. You know, if the wind's right and you got a good surface.
Kind of like being a sailboat, but without the boat. Because a fast sailboat could do that, you know, do that kind of mileage in a day.
Yeah, 800 miles a day is not unheard of. It's pretty routine, and, you know, in some of the further regions out west towards the Bering Sea where you got wind that just comes in almost 24/7.
Yeah, it's always windy there. Wow.
Yeah.
Outdoor Explorer, I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about kiting today, mostly talking about snow kiting so far. And Steve Carr from Alaska Kite Adventures is with me, and John Sedusky, who is a kiting enthusiast and has been doing it for quite a while. So I'm interested in the muscles you use when you're doing this. I know that they... wind is pulling you along, and you've got a harness, right? And how is that? Where is that harness attached? And when at the end of a long day of kiting, which muscles are sore? Because I know which muscles are sore when I'm downhill skiing, when I'm cross country skiing. But this sounds totally different. Who wants to take that one?
John?
Well, that's a good point that you brought up. I think one of the most important muscles are your quads, because just like skiing, they're very important to, if you have those in a good quads and you're in good shape, you can do a lot more mm-hmm. without getting tired. Same thing with whether you're on snow or water or ice with this kiting, as well as windsurfing. But the kite being attached to you is pulling you along. And so it's probably uses less upper body strength than lower body strength. But still, you need to be in pretty good shape to do this because you still have to hang on to the bar. And with four-line kite, you have to be able to sheet it in. And out, and so there is some arm work there too.
Sort of continuous. You never really get to let go of that.
It can be mm-hmm. if a smooth wind. You mm-hmm. may be sheeted in and stay that way. But if it's gusty, you have to let you don't argue with the wind. You just let it out when you have to, and you pull it back in, and just kind of, go with the flow to keep your momentum up and keep from getting, pulled over, mm-hmm. launched in.
What kind of skis do you use? Just regular alpine skis or Telemark or what kind of gear?
Well, you can use what you want, but my opinion is that if you're going to use skis, work better, and a lot of people who do this use skis. There's reasons for that. Snowboards can work, and some people just use exclusively snowboards. But as far as the design of them, I find that it's better to go with an edge that's not too curvy, because you're primarily going in straight directions when you're on snow, and if you have an edge that's designed for turning, it'll scallop on you unless you're in powder. It can be okay. So a straighter edge cut, and I find it something that's not too long, not too short. So you and maybe a little bit wider for flotation and powders. Some mm-hmm. similarities with regular skiing or snowboarding.
Mm-hmm. So you'd rather wear a regular alpine boot?
Yeah. Well, I do, and mm-hmm. and there is a big plus for alpine boots, and that is the when you're edging, sometimes you have so much power, you're just is all you can do just to hang on, hold it, and so that. Stiffness in the boots translates into a good edge control. And same with snowboards, you have to have bindings on there that will hold you in that position. And so that's very important to consider that. Mm-hmm. It's not that you can't do it with, say, cross-country equipment, maybe even ski equipment, but it's going to be more challenging.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Be able to go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, just to further add, this good points John made, and we mostly use a fat ski, something that's what John was saying with a straighter side cut, and keep your speed up that way without a tendency to turn upwind all the time. And the fatter skis, the twin tips that people like for good all around mountain riding and getting into powder as well, that seems to work really well for just about everything kiting. And it's nice to be able to go backwards just as well as forward, too. There's times where that's pretty handy. And so the twin tips are a real big plus. However, you can take your regular downhill and get started on that, and a lot of people do. Uh-huh. So, and speaking about equipment, it's important to note that there is a large group of backcountry guys here in the state.
Yeah.
That a lot of them are out of Girdwood. They're maybe like the ski patrol guys and this mm-hmm. and that. And those guys have really grabbed onto the kiting early, and they're taking this stuff out, on their backcountry trips, skinning out. They get beyond the forest up into the alpine country there, and then they pull out a kite because there's wind, and they can finish their trip and really get onto the ice fields and start mm-hmm. touring around ice fields in one day.
And just use the kite mm-hmm. to pull them up the mountain, so they don't have to.
Yep. And then just traversing around, once you're up there. Uh-huh. And
I guess you mm-hmm. have to wait for the wind and have it blowing roughly in the right direction, right?
Yeah. You have to have wind, basically.
How much wind?
Well, really, on the kiting, at least 6 miles an hour, you pull
that's
up.
That's not that much.
It's not that much. We like it when it's more, above 10. Mm-hmm. Of course, the upper limit, depends on the size of kite you have, but things get pretty rowdy when it gets 35 miles an hour or more.
That's crazy.
It gets real rowdy. Yeah. So, but we can handle that if we got a small kite.
Uh-huh.
But any wind direction, And we're pretty happy because we can maneuver, we can tack, you know, upwind really well. And so we can really make our way.
Huh. That's so kind of hard to, I know how that works on a sailboat when you're sailing towards the wind, you can sail at an angle and the sail sort of bellows and creates a negative pressure in the direction that you want to go. And so you go back and forth across the wind. How does that happen when you've got a kite that's on the end of a rope? Because you don't have a mast that's holding it there right where you want it.
Right. So that actually frees us up. It frees us up to get more performance out of our sailing abilities. Hmm. So, yeah, not having a mast. The mast is really a restriction. And so we combine the ability to park that kite in different parts of our window, so to speak, and combine that with our edging, and we can really break the rules in sailing. It's true. For example, our typical sailboat, and some sailor guys might argue a little bit, but 21 degrees is your typical real steep,
you can't get much closer to the wind than that. Yeah.
We routinely break that. We're pushing like 30 degrees into the wind on a daily basis. Uh-huh. So it's pretty amazing.
Huh. Mm-hmm. So, when you're learning to do this, is that coming intuitively as you're doing trial and error and figuring it out, or does it take a bit of time to kind of get the mental dimension of this?
Are you speaking as a beginner?
Right. Yeah. When you're starting, because it seems like it sounds it's kind of hard to picture, you know. And I can imagine I've suddenly got this big, powerful kite at the end of a rope, and it's pulling on me, and I'm thinking, how do I control this? So, I mean, is that something that you kind of get but through trial and error, or do you sit people down and sort of explain it to them? And I'm just curious as to how you make that leap into being able to do it.
Yeah. So getting into it like that. First of all, having an instructor is key.
Right,
You know, and it's one of those sports, you try to get into it on your own, you're going to get trashed, period, you know. And it's, usually the 20-year-olds kind of venture in that, you know, and learn the hard way. But us older folk can't really do it that way. We'll be in the hospital, you know. Uh-huh. So finding
an instructor. You're going to get dragged along the ground and don't know what you're doing.
That's, that's part of the...
Or not be able to figure out how to make it go.
Correct. That's right, Charles. If you're gonna crash in kiting. There's no way around it as a beginner. You get through that novice stage, and then you get in control of it eventually, and then life gets a lot better, and you're not hitting the deck so much. So you got to plan on that. But how you get there is you stay close to your instructor. We explain all this stuff. Mm-hmm. We have video. We have really good instructional video and a lot of good media to help explain the concepts, and then we just go out into the field and hold their hand right through the process, and it saves people a lot of time and a lot of bruises.
Yeah, so it is like something you need somebody to tell you, like, this is how you're going to catch the wind, this is how you're going to get going.
Yep.
This is it makes sense. Always makes me wonder about the first person to try these things, right? It must have been a lot of trial and error. Do you remember the first time you tried it, John? I mean, what was, did you have some, it didn't sound like you had anybody holding your hand.
No, there wasn't anybody around to do that except for my friend who had the kites, and he is just a little bit more experienced than I was. But I felt like, the basic principles of operating a kite were not too difficult. I could learn that in an afternoon, a couple hours, get the feel for it.
Of course, you'd spend a lot of time balancing on a board, so that probably helps.
Well, that's just standing there. When you add the board or skis or skates, whatever you're on, then you're going to be in motion. You got to be controlling that board and the edges on it. So that adds to the whole
coordination.
Yeah. So generally, instructors are going to teach a person how to handle a kite before they ever get on a board, and it's kind of a land-based situation. Mm-hmm. And then you move on to the water or the snow. And one thing I'd point out is it's often, I think, thought by most people that it's easier to learn on snow at first than it is water. But some people do it the other way around. It's certainly possible.
Well, it's hard just to balance on a board, right? I mean, on the water.
That's true. Mm-hmm. It's water is a lot harder. What John's saying is absolutely true. We have guys that just kind of bailed on the whole water scene, and they're sticking to snow kiting. And just because of the difficulty and the challenges and the cold and everything else they have to go through. But So there's becoming a larger contingent of snow kiters than water kiters here in the state, of course. Yeah. You know,
well, the water is so mm-hmm. cold and so wild, and do it on the water, Steve?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, you down there in Turnagain Arm, it's mm-hmm. windy and. Mm-hmm. And they have these incredible tides and currents and huge waves and all that stuff.
I gotta be honest. I started out down there. It's a wonderful place for water kiting. Uh-huh. But really, the last couple of years, I've been so much in the snow kiting. The water kiting just hasn't been that attractive to me. So I've kind of been a little bit scarce down there. But it is a lot of fun. But it's just a lot more fun in the tropics.
Yeah, because it's so cold. You got to wear all kinds of gear to stay warm and. You know, mm-hmm. the safety issues there, too.
There is, and I think, yeah. you know, John can speak to some of the hazards and risk management that has to go on.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah, I should, because, you know, most of our water kiting is done right in Turnagain Arm, and, you know, it's just a natural wind tunnel, and that's why we started years ago windsurfing, because it has the elements we're looking for, and particularly the wind, and a lot of it. And so the kiting was just a natural thing to move on to because of the similarities of the sport. We do it in a little bit different locations because of different reasons. But I think that it really depends on the wind speed is a factor for some people. They may want to limit the amount of wind they go out in. I personally like the stronger wind. I find it more exciting, and you get more waves right on. You can usually do pretty good size jumps and that kind of stuff. And it's I just like it. It probably relates to the years of windsurfing, which I pretty much like to focus on the same time sort of thing. So it works out really good. But if you want lighter winds, it's not as easy to find lighter winds in this arm.
Yeah, that's right. Did you start your first time on a windsurfing here in Alaska, or do you start like in Hawaii or somewhere that was a little bit easier?
Well, I did start in Hawaii. I think it was back in 1980, maybe. I took a lesson over there, and that was very helpful. As Steve pointed out, and I think kiting is even more important because you can the potential of getting hurt in kiting and by making a mistake with that kite is significant. We've already had some people hurt by doing the wrong things, and not that you can't get hurt with windsurfing, but it functions differently, and so it's not as probable. Although I have got hurt over the years, windsurfing a few times, but I still would not let that hold me back. Like the important thing is to get the instruction, and then you know what you're doing. And that's really the key to being safe in this sport.
Yeah, over the years, we've had a few people who just jumped in the water down there on Turnagain Arm and really got in serious trouble, haven't we?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, it's the element of danger, too. You know, it's one of the reasons we like it, I guess.
Yeah.
Some of us. You know, there is always that.
You like to push yourself out on the edge a little bit and just have that thrill of you don't know exactly what's going to happen.
There's a lot of thrill seekers out there that'll just jump into it. Even as a advanced kiter that knows what you're doing, there's always that element. There's always uh-huh. an element of the wind and interfacing with nature, and of course you're, you know, kind of pushing it. But that element of danger is kind of attractive, and so you know, Mother Nature, you never know what's going to deliver. So that's kind of an unknown, and you know, it can get gusty really fast and start kicking your butt. You know?
Well, that's one of the great things about any kind of wind sport, I think, is that mm-hmm. you are really relying on the forces of nature. You're not bringing fuel to it. You're not bringing a motor. It's your wits and a piece mm-hmm. of fabric, whether that's sailing or kiting mm-hmm. or any of these sports. Well, it's a great topic. We've got another half hour left after the break, and we're going to talk about how you can get involved in this sport. Maybe talk about some of these hazards that you've been mm-hmm. alluding to, but we haven't really gotten into. And the equipment, how much does it cost to do this? So much more to come on Outdoor Explorer with my guests, Steve Carr and John Sadusky. But first, we're going to take a break and let our producer, Monica Gokey, take over for a few minutes. She checked in with an event called the Alaska Snow Kite Jam over the weekend in Girdwood. And you're listening to it on Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth.
This past weekend was the second annual Snow Kite Jam. It's an event put on by a couple of diehards who show visiting kiters the best of what Alaska has to offer. This year, people came from Puerto Rico, Texas, Alberta, and Brazil. There was only one problem. Driving out to Girdwood, where everyone is staying, Turnagain Arm looked like a pond. The water was glassy and calm, which meant one thing for Alaska's visiting kiters. There was no wind.
Right now, I'm looking at a sensor at Portage, and it's zero. Turnagain Pass.
At the morning briefing at Hotel Alyeska, everyone is glued to their smartphones, checking data from local wind sensors on NOAA's website. But conditions weren't looking good.
There's better wind conditions in some places than others, and it's just Mother Nature doing its thing, right? I just have to hope for the best when we go kite.
That was Jack Zwanenberg, who's visiting from Alberta. He's kited all over the world, but this is his first trip to Alaska. And waiting for the weather, he says, is all a part of the sport. The day before, Jack and some others chartered a flight over the Kenai in search of wind.
No, it's been, yesterday was a real awesome experience in that small plane flying over the mountaintops, and where we were, the location, it was incredible.
They didn't find the treasure trove of wind they'd hoped for, but Jack said he got his kite up in the air for about 45 minutes, and that was enough time to log some good turns. Last year, conditions were better at the Snow Kite Jam. It was the first time Juan Carlos Morales,
I'm from Puerto Rico,
had been to Alaska. He's been kite surfing on the water for more than 15 years, but doing it on the snow, that's still sort of new to him.
We came here because we were looking for terrain to learn how to glide.
Gliding is when kiters lift into the air for prolonged amounts of time, sometimes over a half a minute. And it's what a lot of these guys are here to do, especially the more advanced ones. It's about as close as they come to flying.
Just the glides were the most amazing. When you're up there and you're looking down and you're like, wow, you know, it just feels really good.
Juan Carlos said even though he gets to kite surf all the time on the water at home, the novelty of doing it on the snow is what keeps him coming north.
It's out of my comfort zone because I'm not from the snow, so that's maybe why I like it.
Juan Carlos brought two friends with him from Puerto Rico to this year's Snow Kite Jam. And like a lot of people from warmer climates who have only kite surfed on water, they're totally new to the snow here.
It was the first time I've seen snow, actually. So
that was Felix Cuadrado. And Felix isn't the only one here who's never been on the snow before. There's another guy from Dallas, also an avid kite surfer on the water, but who just wanted to give it a try on the snow this time. Later in the day, the Snow Kite Jam headed out to Big Lake, where wind conditions were a bit better. And later in the week, they loaded up in a couple of RVs and headed for Thompson Pass, where there's a big snow kite festival happening this weekend. The last we heard, they were scoring some great wind conditions. Snowkiters, like other extreme sport enthusiasts, are well-versed in the art of using GoPro cameras. You can see one of the Snow Kite Jam's videos from last year by logging on to our website at outdoorexplorer.org. If the videos tell you one thing, it's this. It's absolutely amazing what these guys and gals can do with their brightly colored kites and Alaska's blustery wind. In Girdwood, I'm Monica Goki for Outdoor Explorer.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer, and I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about kiting, snow kiting, and also on the water, and going to get into all the different aspects of it with my guest, Steve Carr, who's with Alaska Kite Adventures, and John Sadusky, a longtime pioneer of wind sports in Alaska. Steve, that, you know, there's a lot of different forms or ways of doing this. And for folks who don't know much about it, which I think is almost everyone, what are the different forms of the sport?
Yes, it's really important to mention that, you know, we've already touched on snow kiting, using skis and snowboard. There's also something called an ice buggy. I've actually used out on the lake. So it's kind of
ice sailing. Is
ice boating.
Kind of the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And this is just a three-bladed buggy that you can rally around on the lakes. And a buddy of mine out in the valley has one.
It's, those are crazy fast, right?
It's really fast.
Super fast.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. So there, you know, there's all kinds of directions you can go and forms. And it's really just only limited to your imagination. Uh-huh. It's kind of exciting. Let's talk about kite surfing. It's more than just being on a kite board and rallying around on the flats. You know, most people are already familiar with surfing on waves. So you can actually, you know, grab a surfboard or get a kite-specific surfboard and do that. And then there's this little-known thing of a kite boat. And we actually have one, believe it or not. And it's pretty cool.
Wow, what's that?
Well, it's like a little catamaran, and they're exclusively being built in New Zealand, and we actually have one, and it's kind of fun. It's a single man, little
sort of like
small
Hobie Cat type boat,
a small version of a Hobie, and it's about 80 pounds, and you can just sit in a seat and fly your kite and go boating around.
So the kite is attached to the boat, then?
Nope, it's attached to you, just like normal.
Oh my gosh.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And that way, if you have a out of boat experience, get, you know, jacked by a gust, you know, you don't tip over, you just fly out of your seat. So it's kind of safe that way.
Wow, crazy. So then the boat and you are in different places at that point.
Yeah, it's easy. It's fairly easy to get back in. The important part when you're on the water is always stay connected to your kite.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, because you don't even need a boat. You know, I mean, when you're on the water, your safety is being hooked to that kite.
Why is that?
Well, you could always self-rescue yourself. As long as you're hooked to the kite, you can move around with just your body, just skirting through the water. Uh-huh. We call it body dragging, but we can always get back to the boat or get back to shore or, you know, whatever we need to, as long as we're hooked to that kite.
As long as the kite's up in the air, I guess.
Yep, that's important. And the last form that doesn't get talked about much here in Alaska is traction kiting, and that's just simply kiting on land. It's more popular in Lower 48, where they have deserts and big dry lake beds and lots of hard-packed coastline. And guys go out there with, you know, kite buggies, which is just a three-wheeled little buggy. And they jam around, and they also use boards. it's kind of a mountain board thing. It's a large skateboard with large wheels, and they rally around with those things.
Wow, I never heard of all this stuff. It's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah, how long has this stuff been around? I mean, how long has it sort of been in this explosive phase of all these different things happening?
Man, John, you want to? It's
last 10 years.
Yeah. I mean, definitely within the 2000s, things have really blown up. Say 2002. What do you think, John? For just about everything going crazy.
Well. As far as up here, you could say back into the 2000, but really there was kiting going on in a lot of different parts of the world of different types prior to that. Because like I was saying before, and Steve said, we're oftentimes late in the game. You know, when the world's been doing it for a while, the sport gets attractive up here to people, and we do it if we can. So I think that... it was just like windsurfing. It started at some point in some place. People claim it was in the U.S., some people in Europe, but it eventually spread, and we got into the game later up here.
And now in Alaska, sort of the pioneering part for us is maybe these long point-to-point expeditions and covering a lot of ground. Steve, I mean, you're talking about how there's different ways of using these things, different aspects of the sport that bring you into like totally different kind of ways that you can get out there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's a really exciting thing for this whole thing. You know, what you usually see is the guys sporting around. We call it performance kiting sometimes. If you're driving by turning an arm, you see a guy's kiting in one general area and just doing a lot of tricks and jumping and having fun like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your performance kiting. But there's also just cruising. Just cruising along, enjoying the scenery. It doesn't have to be a real serious, you know, workout or anything. You can
kind
just...
Kind of the difference between touring the backcountry or going to Alyeska and going off jumps.
Yep, exactly. So you can just tour, and it's nothing to just relax, let the wind pull you. You can go for 8 hours. I mean, it's not... It's not that difficult to just mm-hmm. tour around on a kite on the snow. And then there's...
But you got to be, I mean, you've got to, given that the terrain will allow you to, right? Because you got to be away from trees and you don't want to be in, you know, cliff conditions. And there are certain limitations in that.
There is. You really need to be, it's all about location. So you need mm-hmm. to be in places like, tundra, the tundra right. zones, like in western Alaska all the way to the Bering Sea. It's my favorite place. Uh-huh. And then, of course, you can be up from like the Brooks Range all the way down the slope to the Arctic Sea. Yeah. And those areas are completely treeless. They have wind consistently, and you can tour for hundreds and hundreds of miles in each direction. It's amazing.
Cool. So go on with the other aspects.
Well, just this, adventure kiting is pretty cool. We can get up into these ice fields and tour or just do day trips, whatever you need to do there. We touched briefly on doing some expeditions. So if you want to explore a new area and don't have to rely on gas, as long as you know that area is treeless and has some wind, you can do it. And mm-hmm. you can pull sleds. And that leads me right into using kites as utility. And that's starting to happen now in rural areas of Alaska where, say, for example, snow machine gas is $7, $8 a gallon. And I have been able to introduce kites to people that live in villages in remote Alaska.
Really? Like what areas?
Well, I started in Bethel, mm-hmm. and there's now a contingent of kiters out there.
Wow.
Yeah, and they're touring. They're going from village to village.
And so you like take a polk type sled and attach that to your waist, and you've also got the kite attached to you, or how do you do that?
Yeah, you're attached as normal. and then as far as your sled, we've actually rigged up a rope tow system that we like better than the polk, and we put a little special custom bungee in there that just mm-hmm. has the right tension to, you know, take that shock, you know. Uh-huh.
Right.
And but utility, man, I think it's going to get really popular, and people can pull some cargo with them. They can pull their overnight gear like a normal snow machine would do, and but it's just without paying, you know, the high mm-hmm. gas bill.
So. Steve mentioned some areas which most of us don't get to go to that often, although the northern, you know, foothills of the Brooks Range are incredibly beautiful, mm-hmm. you know, for hiking. It sounds like kiting for any mm-hmm. anything you can do if you can get up there. What about areas right around Anchorage? Where do you like to go, John?
Well, Anchorage is not the prime place to be kiting on land. And the reason is because when the wind goes over trees and buildings and stuff, it messes it up. It's not just smooth, and it can be pretty gnarly. But we do have some places we go. Jewel Lake, which most people know about, is good on a north wind. And I know Tom Fredrickson has done some teaching there in the past, and it works out pretty good because it's in town and it's close.
Mm-hmm. Potter's Marsh, maybe?
Potter's Marsh works. It's a problem because of the wind directions, and then you have quite a few years where there's not as good snow cover, and so you've got branches and twigs and stuff out there, but it can work, mm-hmm. both for ice kiting and snow kiting, depending on the situation. I think one of the best spots is actually right alongside where we do most of our kiting in the summer, which is along the coastal flats, all the way down to Kincaid Park.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great place for crust skiing and for all kinds of stuff. Yeah,
there's a lot of open area
people
there.
People are starting to discover it out mm-hmm. there. Yeah.
Well, we've been doing it for some time, but it's right, getting the right conditions where you have the snow, decent snow cover, and you have enough wind. And usually that's going to be the same kind of wind that comes off the inlet. Mm-hmm. There's a little problem in the winter, though. We don't normally get the change of angle that we do in the summer because of the thermal aspect of the sun heating it up in the late afternoon, and that often creates a low pressure north of us, which pulls that air over Anchorage. And mm-hmm. most anybody that lives in the west part of Anchorage or south knows that is a regular routine in the summer. In the wintertime, it happens less, but it does happen occasionally, and so that can work pretty good out there.
Mm-hmm. Any other suggestions, Steve, for places to go, maybe not in town, but near?
Yeah, just for Anchorage people, just trying to get out of town and find a spot. I mean, Eklutna Lake, as John's kind of been a pioneer up there, mm-hmm. and it's got its quirks, but a consistent spot has been going east. Portage Lake, it's been real popular, and yeah. And if you're willing to, well, in the same area, there's always that field at 20 Mile, along 20 Mile River. If you're willing to go a little further up, you can get into the mountains. Turnigan Pass has been real popular. Mm-hmm. It can be fickle, but when it's on, it's really fun. If you wanted to go north, up to the valley, where we have our new location now, and those lakes up there for lake kiting can be pretty darn consistent. Our main shop is on Lake Lucille, and it's gets wind every day, pretty much. Sometimes too windy. Well, a lot of times too windy, actually. Mm-hmm. So we do a lot of our lessons out at Big Lake. Mm-hmm. There's a real consistent north wind that comes across the west side of Big Lake, and it's proved to be really good for us.
Yeah, cool.
And so if a guy is willing to maybe go even further, you can get down to Kenai. Of course, you got freezing issues sometimes there. Mm-hmm. Kenai Lake, it's in Ski Lake. It's roadside kiting.
Big areas, yeah.
Big, mm-hmm. big lakes, yep.
It's so. Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about snow kiting today, and my guests are both experts on the subject. Steve Carr, who has a business, part of a business that teaches folks how to do this, and John Sadusky, who's an enthusiast. I don't want to get too much farther without talking about the equipment and what it costs to get into this sport and how you get into it, because obviously these kites are a pretty serious piece of equipment. Do most people go out and buy one or rent one, or how do you do it, and how much does it cost?
Yeah, most people give us a call first. Mm-hmm. We're all over the web and through different kiters out here, the old hearsay thing, but
yeah, and we're getting a link up on our page at alaskapublic.org so people can find you.
Sure. So you're getting into the gear, we'll discuss with the people what exactly they want to do, where they want to go, and it makes a difference. So there's a little bit of knowledge there that you mm-hmm. got to build, make a correct decision, and we'll help them get into the right kite and gear. There's a bunch of associated gear with it. There's some safety stuff to know. And as far as cost, it's all over the place, but I'll try to narrow it down for you. Your snow kite, a lot of people start off with one kite, and you can spend $1,200, $1,500 right there just on a kite, and then you're talking about a harness. Throw another $150 at that, and then if you already have skis, well, you're in. So
right.
That's it,
right.
and you're kiting. So it's a one-time cost for many, many years, years to come, and you can
If you just want to try it out, can you borrow one or rent one?
We actually offer an intro class for that for mm-hmm. $150. They can come out. They can we can put a kite in your hand. You can watch us kite. We can discuss different things and mm-hmm. Answer questions. And that intro class is really handy for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then if they choose to go ahead and go for it, we'll go ahead and apply that. That money's towards their actual lessons, mm-hmm. and we offer different levels of kiting lessons too. Uh-huh. So
what are some of these safety aspects that we need to talk about? And let's talk about snow kiting, then I'll also talk about kiteboarding, because I know that there's some things that people need to be aware of. We were talking earlier about some things that they do on TV. We do on and experts do, like going way aloft, that a novice would not want to try. What are some other issues, ways you can get hurt?
Well, I always look at most any of these type of active sports as a risk-reward ratio, and I think it's an individual's choice as to how much risk you want to take for the reward you get out of what you're doing. And we each have to make that choice ourselves. And so I always encourage everybody to stay within their limits, not somebody else's limits, mm-hmm. As far beyond that, the instructions is the key. But there is one thing I would like to mention about kites: the way they're designed as the safety releases, which probably will help people understand that there is a way out if things get really bad. So there's two safety systems. One is the chicken loop, which is a loop that's hooked to the harness hook. There is generally a safety release on that, and if you want to get out, get away from that kite, you just pull that. It releases that loop, and you're away from the kite. But that doesn't mean your kite goes taken off downwind from you, because it's designed with another backup system, which is designed to hook onto a leash. And what that generally does is go to your front lines, which kind of luffs the kite. Sometimes it'll just be one front line. Anyway, you don't lose your kite. It just luffs it. And so then you've got rid of the power, but you don't lose the kite. Unless it's so strong where that leash line breaks, which I've had happen to me, and your kite takes off and you have to go get it. So that's one issues that can happen, but those systems are,
like
are
key to understand. You're going too fast, you feel like you're out of control, so you can pull the release and you've gotten rid of the power. But what are, you know, Steve, you were talking about beginners getting knocked down a lot. Is that sort of a, I mean, the falls, is that the main way people might get hurt? Or what are some of the, or sort of ending up in terrain they don't expect to be in, or what are sort of the major hazards warn people about?
That's pretty much, you just mentioned a couple of good things. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to point out there is that, falling and crashing is pretty much a prerequisite. I mean, it's going to happen during your learning curve, you know, as a novice. Once you get past that, you really get the control down to where that just doesn't happen unless you're taking real at risk.
Just like learning to ski, basically.
It's really similar to skiing. Yeah. It's really just like that. And so it gets to a point where you're in control enough where you're making the decisions. And that's the important part, where you can control the amount of risk, really. And that's all decision making, you know. It comes down to that, really. Mm-hmm. If you're looking at a zone that might be too rowdy, you have a choice to go down there and try to kite that. It might spank you, and it might not. But you have those choices. And mm-hmm. So
when you look at at serious injuries that occur, somebody pushing the edge and trying to take too much air, or go through terrain that might be a little bit too gnarly and they run into a rock or something, those kinds of issues?
Yeah, that's true. You try to stay on terrain, of course, to start off with, like lakes, that's nice, or, it's safe, and then you migrate to more dangerous spots, and it's all, you know, it's it's all, every time you switch, you know, locations, you have to learn that zone and understand what the dangers are. So it's pretty important stuff. And there's a bit of that comes with experience. And then there's also a portion of that we can teach too. So,
I was really interested in seeing that the wind would have enough power to really haul you up a mountain. And even, I guess, even haul you straight up into the air. And, but that the kite may not be really built as a flying machine, right? And so you have to be thoughtful about that.
Yeah, going airborne is never a good idea with these kites. They weren't designed to be gliders. There's only four connection points. If just one of those breaks, you're pretty much gonna come out of the sky. Mm-hmm. So they're really loaded up more than you would a paraglider, so to speak. You know, like, it's not a good idea to be trying to fly and glide. Although, you know, we do it. People do it as experts. It's mostly for the camera.
Okay.
It's really considered a stunt.
Hear you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do that kind of thing, John?
I like to jump, yes. Uh-huh. It's a fun part of it, but I understand the risk of doing it. And there's a couple of things I do to limit that risk. For instance, if I'm in water, if I'm up 20 feet and I come down, it's, you know, you're going to land in the water. It's not so bad, as long as you have enough water to land in. You don't want it to be landed too shallow. But on snow and ice, it's a different situation. And particularly ice, as you can guess, when you fall on ice, it is hard.
Yeah.
And so I wear padding. I wear elbow pads. I have hip padding, and I have knee pads and helmet. And I've used all of those at some point.
Mm-hmm.
With the snow kiting, it varies so much, because you can be in 2 feet of soft powder, or you can be in hard packed snow, which is not much different than ice if you come down. So
right.
you have to think about, well, if things go bad, how bad is this landing going to be? And I've had a couple of bad landings from getting gusts and getting hauled up, and so I know what it's like. You can come down and hit pretty hard, and in two cases I hit back of my head. So you have to be thinking all the time. What Steve was alluding to, I think I could sum up in a simple situation, is that you can learn two ways: by learning from other people's mistakes or your own.
Right.
And so it's better to talk to the people who have already got experience, and extensively.
I like that. I'm going to use that. That's good. Yeah. Learn from other people's mistakes. So, Stephen, in a couple of minutes we have left, where is the sport going? I mean, what do you see as the it sounds like it's developing at a really rapid rate. What kind of developments are happening, or what's happening with it in terms of the future?
Yeah, so it's pretty exciting where it's going. You know, I've already touched on, you know, people are using more devices to get out there on, little boats and buggies and all these kinds of things.
Uh-huh.
And
cross country distances and all that.
Going cross country. And so a lot of that future I see is really a practical means of travel. I'm pretty excited about it, actually.
Uh-huh.
And with a rising price of gas, if you can get out and use the wind, like people have been using the wind for, eons, crossing the oceans and everything, we can use the kites really the same way, as long as it's fairly treeless terrain, which we have a lot of in this state, actually.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it.
Yeah, well, we've done shows about people riding their bikes all the way across Alaska and back, riding snow machines from Alaska to the eastern side of Canada. Pretty soon, somebody's going to like kite across Alaska. Right?
Absolutely, yeah, you bet. And I also want to mention too, this can be a family sport too. We have kiters that are discovered that they can tow their kids on a sled and get the whole family out there and enjoy it on a nice mellow day on a lake and stay pretty safe with it. So that could happen too, and
cool.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And so you, we'll have your link up on the website for folks who want to get into the sport. Is there a club in town or anything like that for people to get involved, or pretty much just your business?
It's pretty much just a loose network of kiters around the general Anchorage area and us in the valley. If they wanted to get into the sport or just learn more, yeah, go to our website there at AlaskaKiteAdventures.com.
All right. Yep. Well, thanks a lot, guys. I've had Steve Carr, who you were just hearing from, Alaska Kite Adventures, and John Sadusky, who's pioneered some of this kiting here in Alaska. My name is Charles Wolforth. On next week's show, I'm planning, if I can get everything to come together, to talk about Inupiaq whaling. It's a topic I've written about in a book called The Whale and the Supercomputer, and I'm going to have some native whalers from Barrow, some scientists, be on the show about the season that's just getting started. And that show also coincides with our spring pledge drive here at KSKA, so we'll hope that people will be getting on the phones and contributing to the station at the same time. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.